So, good afternoon to Dr. Tim Lomas, author of one of the co-authors of The Second Wave of Positive Psychology. Good afternoon, Tim.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining me today. Just wanted to talk some questions about the second wave of positive psychology, if that's okay. So, first of all, what is the second wave of positive psychology?
Okay, well, we're hopefully not being too hubristic in labelling this the second wave. I think we have to put it into context of how the field was when it first emerged. You know, the origin story was that psychology as usual tended to focus more on distress and dysfunction, and there really wasn't much attention generally paid to, you know, the brighter sides of functioning, to constructs like happiness and flourishing and well-being. So I think positive psychology did everyone a wonderful service by coming along and shining a light on these important topics relating to well-being. And I think obviously met with such enthusiasm and such generated such excitement because it really served an important need, because people wanted to find out about important processes and qualities, whether it's in optimism and hope, find out how to promote these in people's lives, how to help people lead better lives, which is all, I think, incredibly valuable. So the last thing we want to do in kind of talking about the second wave is imply that any of that was errant or wrong or flawed, because I don't think it was. I think it was all very useful. But what I think was, as this first wave, if you like, of research got underway, various nuances began to be picked up. And I think some of these were, you know, even present from the start and even before the start of positive psychology. So, for example, I always refer to the fact that in Seligman's book in 1990, he talks about perhaps people being wary of the tyrannies of optimism and being able to use pessimism's keen sense of reality when you need it. So back there in 1990, I think sort of Seligman was saying that it's not just we should valorize optimism as this, you know, unqualified good and view pessimism as necessarily intrinsically bad thing. So as the field got going, I think it, you know, it focused on processes and qualities like optimism and so on. And then in that process of researching these qualities, it would note occasions, for example, on which optimism might not always be beneficial to well-being. You know, and conversely, some qualities like pessimism or anxiety in particular circumstances could actually be conducive to flourishing. So for us, we felt that when you get into this territory, when things that we label ostensibly as being positive actually can be negative, if you will, yeah, and vice versa, qualities that we would construct as being negative, like anxiety, actually could help in terms of flourishing, which means the negative becomes a positive. So it kind of problematizes and critiques the very idea of positive and negative. Now, for me, that doesn't in any way undermine the idea of positive psychology at all. I think it just means that as the field grows and develops, we're collectively starting to get a bit more of a, you know, nuanced sense of the contextualization of particular qualities under which circumstances are certain things positive and negative, as it were. So for us, rather than undermining the field of positive psychology, we just felt that it was, with all this research that's been happening over the last 10 years or so, the field is moving into a slightly different plane, a slightly different level, as it were. And we just gave a label to this with second wave positive psychology. So it's not like we're suggesting everyone else has been doing things as a, you know, as a sort of first wave approach, and here we are with this bold new second wave approach. That's not what we're suggesting. It's more just we're recognizing trends and patterns that have been ongoing in the field for the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Like I say, critiquing positive and negative, for example, recognizing that we need to perhaps engage with the difficulties of life. They can actually be useful and valuable in some respects and be conducive to flourishing. And so just grouping all of this kind of emergent research under the label of second wave. So for me, that's perhaps the second wave in a nutshell.
And thank you very much for that. And Do you feel that this this is something that's needed now for the field?
I would say perhaps. I mean, I think it would probably still get along fine without us coining this idea or bringing this book out. It certainly doesn't need our help in that respect. But I think it can hopefully bring something to the field, something useful. It can open up this conceptual space where people can bring in slightly more unusual qualities, topics of interest. So, for example, things that could be considered part of the darker aspects of life, uncomfortable emotions, the fact that, these can be part of positive psychology, for example, Itai, my colleague, writes about psychological growth can often mean, encountering and transcending difficult aspects of ourselves. So I might only grow personally if I encounter an aspect of myself that is problematic and perhaps painful to face up to. But then it's necessary to engage with that in order to transcend and develop and to grow. So I think it's recognizing that things that we might deem to be negative can still serve flourishing and adaptation and well-being. So it can perhaps expand our way of, expand our horizons of concern in the field. That's okay. So I think it's useful in that respect. I also think it can help in terms of making other people feel more welcome in the field, because I think one of the motivations for the book was some conversations we'd had with people, and they felt there was this, to engage with positive psychology or to study it or to follow it or to believe in it, the sense that you had to be feeling positive or you had to be feeling upbeat. And I don't think scholars in the field want to give that impression, but that's certainly how some people could feel. That if they were feeling sad or anxious, that it wasn't really for them, and it's only something you can engage with if life is going well, which we felt was a real shame, because it meant that people who might really be in need of positive psychology, at difficult times in their life, perhaps felt it wasn't for them. Perhaps they could feel that their sense of sadness or anxiety, wasn't normal, they shouldn't be feeling that way, they should be feeling positive. So perhaps they may not have felt as welcome as they might have done in the field. So if we open up this space where those qualities can be talked about and engaged with, it could perhaps be more inclusive and welcoming. And then, we all know the criticism about positive psychology being a smiley face and yeah. positive thinking. So I think for critics of the field as well, we can show that it's not about, us within the field, we know it's not about that. We know it's not about people just thinking positively and so on. But critics from the field can sometimes get that impression. So I think by opening up this, this idea of the second wave, it can hopefully disarm some of the critics, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense to me. I think it's a great way of balancing out what you're saying about the happy, smiley face and that people feeling almost like a pressure to feel positive and have those happy feelings when in reality, that's not going to be realistic.
Well, that's true, because I think there's an interesting scholar called Barbara Held, and she wrote of the sort of tyranny of the positive. And in fact, she was very influential in our whole idea of coming up with the second wave. And in fact, that very label actually comes from one of her papers. She called this a kind of second wave within the field. So we've kind of taken her concept and taken inspiration from her. And she would call this pressure perhaps to feel happy, to feel positive as a somewhat of a tyranny of the positive.
Yeah.
It's obviously quite a strong polemical word, but I see what she's getting at. So hopefully this can alleviate that pressure that we should feel happy. Obviously, if you do feel happy and positive, that's wonderful. Don't feel bad if you do. But it's like, if you're not feeling that way, then you shouldn't chastise yourself.
Exactly.
Because I often think of that Buddhist concept of the two arrows, that however you may be feeling might be a first arrow. So if you're feeling sad and that hits you like an arrow and that's painful enough, but then our meta feelings about feelings, you might feel despairing of the fact that we're feeling sad rather than it just being what's happening for us at that moment.
Yeah.
So that tyranny can be perhaps the second arrow that can kind of double up on our pain and suffering. So, yeah.
No, that's great. Thank you very much.
All right.
And what areas of the second wave positive psychology are of keen interest to you?
Well, I think for me, in our second wave book, the first chapter I did was on the dialectics of emotion.
Yeah.
So I know you might want to ask me about, you were planning on asking me about that.
Yeah, that was a good time.
I'll leave that in here in a way, because in the dialectics of emotion, it was really taking that critical idea that what seems to be positive could be negative, and what seems to be negative could be positive. So in that chapter, I was kind of tracing the way in which optimism, for example, in certain circumstances, could be disadvantageous or detrimental to well-being. You know, there's, for example, a study showing that perhaps what we'd call excessive optimism would lead to a misapprehension of risk, and then to subsequent health risk behaviours like smoking, because people are optimistic that they won't get ill, for example.
Yeah.
And then the converse would be qualities like pessimism could be really useful. For example, if it meant you did some proactive coping and were cautionary and took care of things in advance. So in that chapter, I was really interested in going through a number of different qualities and saying, well, actually, in certain situations, that what seems to be positive could be negative, and vice versa. So in terms of what current areas of the second wave are interesting me, well, for a start, I'm currently just finishing writing a book.
Another one already? Another one already?
Yeah, but I can't seem to stop. But this is a non-academic one for more of a general audience. And then trying to look at different negative emotions in turn, and not simply just to normalize them, but to say how these could be harnessed in a skillful way to help people flourish.
Yeah.
Whether that's anger. So, for example, one of the chapters on anger was based on a review I also did on anger, that it can be a moral emotion, you know? So it's not always a moral emotion. People sometimes just get angry. But it can be a moral emotion, a sign that, for example, some, you know, ethic has been breached, some line has been crossed. And perhaps if that's harnessed in the right way, it might lead people to want to improve their situation. So, for example, you can talk about a sense of appropriate anger, not a hateful anger, but certain types of anger underpinning some of the great social progressive movements.
Yeah.
For example. Or, you know, conversely, internally, you could think about guilt, and then reflecting on one's sense of guilt might lead you to try to become a better person. My interest would be really trying to look at these different negative emotions and saying, well, actually, they're not just perhaps, you know, normal and appropriate, but actually they can be useful and can be harnessed to help people, you know, flourish, to lead better lives.
Yeah.
So that's of particular interest to me. And then I've also been taking a real interest in, I think I did this in the chapter, but trying to take this notion of dialectics and the interaction between positive and negative, and then link it back to sort of dialectical philosophies like Buddhism and Taoism, which obviously, say particularly Taoism, was essentially founded on this appreciation of dialectics.
Yeah.
As exemplifying the yin-yang symbol. And you find that too in Zen Buddhism. And then I've been getting very absorbed in looking, for example, at Zen aesthetics.
Okay.
Certain aesthetic principles that kind of capture this appreciation of dialectics, and that these could perhaps be used by us to cultivate that kind of appreciation. So finding that very fascinating moment, to be honest, it's quite, it blows your mind a bit, because it's all, you feel like you're going into very strange areas with this, and especially with some of the Zen aesthetic stuff. But I enjoy trying to take these new ideas on and try and develop different theories and models. So it's all very interesting.
Yeah. And I think one of your co-authors, Dr. Piers Worth, would say you're pushing the boundaries of the map, or the edge of the map.
Pushing the edge of the map. Exactly. Well, yeah, I think we tried to. I think everyone in the field is, in their own way. They're all we're all sort of expanding and developing the field, and this is our contribution. Like I say, the one thing I'd hate to give this sense of, it's everyone else is still mired in this first wave of thinking, and there's only us pushing the boundaries. I think everybody is.
Yeah.
Everyone's challenging preconceived notions. Everyone is developing their models and their concepts in really interesting ways, and engaging with, you know, in thoughtful ways with, you know, critiques of the field. And this is just our little contribution to that, I think. So, and like I say, it's not just us. I think lots of other scholars are working on ideas that we would perhaps see as fitting within the second wave. Whether they do or not, they might not want to see themselves in that way. But we would say that, you know, we draw on their work. So people like McNulty and Fincham talk about contextual approach to positive psychology. So for me, that's very much part of what we're doing. Obviously, people like our leading light and mentor, Paul Wong, who really pioneered this territory. I know, obviously, Kashtan and Biswas Dina with their great book, Upside of the Downside. I mean, I'm not sure what they would think of this notion of second wave positive psychology per se, but for me, what they were doing was very emblematic of what we're trying to do in terms of critiquing positive and negative, and challenge thinking in that way. So I just think there's a lot happening in the field, and then we're just hoping to contribute to it, trying to bring it together in this way.
Yeah. No, it's a great contribution, I think.
Hello, thank you.
It's a great book. And then just my final question for you is, you talk about in one of your chapters about compassion, and about how that as well can be a strength and a virtue.
Gosh, yeah, well, because compassion, it's such a strange thing, isn't it? Because it's so valorized and upheld as this vital quality that people should cultivate, which I absolutely agree with.
Yeah.
But then when you think about it, it intrinsically involves negative emotions and suffering, because it's the etymology of the word is suffering with. You know, you're taking on another person's suffering, and you're responding with, you know, insight and empathy, and hoping to help them. So you're necessarily feeling these dysphoric emotions when you're, you know, being compassionate. And yet no one would say compassion was a bad thing. It's you know, it's intrinsically valuable and necessary and worthwhile. So for me, it just seemed a real kind of emblematic of this second wave idea, and, you know, really seemed to exemplify it.
Yeah.
What it meant was, you know, the fact that if it does involve dysphoric negative emotions, but ultimately it's so important, so valuable, and so integral to flourishing. And then really got me thinking, you know, what is it about compassion that's so then important? So one idea I had was, you know, we would obviously recognize compassion as being valuable to the recipient. You know, they'll be helped and they'll feel cared for and so on. And it's also obviously valuable for society. You know, it might underpin a system of morals and so on. But then I also felt that it's actually so important to the actor themselves.
Yeah.
And for me, I would speculate the reason that is because it brings them out of themselves. You know, they transcend their narrow sense of self-identity and connect with another human being. And even though they're connecting because they're sharing their suffering, they're still becoming part of, you know, a dyad or a community that's larger than themselves, which takes them out of their own ego. Which, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, for example, would, you know, lead them on to kind of higher levels of psycho-spiritual development. So I just think it's one of those really interesting qualities that, you know, in base terms is a negative emotion, but we wouldn't, it's not negative in its impact or its effects ultimately.
No.
So that's why it was really emblematic, I felt, of this whole second wave idea that things that ostensibly seem negative are actually can be positive and conducive towards, you know, flourishing, which was what me why it was so interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I love that. I love the way you put that. Well, thank you very much then, Tim.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Hope that the second wave of positive psychology goes from strength to strength. I know that it's a very popular book. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dan. Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks.